I want to begin my remarks with a kind of personal account. Last November, when my wife and I were ready to listen to the evening news and hear the results of the elections, we gathered in front of the television with a great deal of anticipation, with a certain amount of apprehension, I might say. Not over the electoral contest, because it was very clear that Hillary was going to win. I was wearing my Hillary t-shirt. I, of course, also had my Bernie cap. I got the Hillary t-shirt later, but we were ready to settle in to cheer the victory, but we had some apprehension about the House and Senate races, because our fear was that even though certainly Hillary would win, all the polls indicated that would be the case, the earlier grand lead that showed that her coattails would bring in both the House of Representatives and the Senate on the Democratic side appeared to be not as certain on that evening. And we were afraid that she would have the same problem that Obama had of being a president with great vision and great ideas, but with a Congress and a Senate that was determined to keep her from achieving her goals. So that's the most that we were worried about. Certainly, it was inconceivable that someone like Trump could win the presidency. I mean, after all, it was not just his retrograde policies, insofar as he had policies. I mean, he was, after all, just a showman, a TV Parker, a failed businessman who was under investigation for the failure of a number of his businesses, who were accused of sexual abuse, who a demeanor that was insulting, would belittle women and minorities and racial groups of Muslims. A disgusting person, really, in addition to being a hideous politician. How could anyone imaginably think that someone like this become president of the United States? So we put that out of the mind. We were waiting for to cheer the election and be concerned about the Senate races. And as the evening went on, well, certainly the earlier returns must be wrong. Certainly the firewall will be the northern states, the tier of states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. But certainly those votes will come out in favor of Hillary, and that will finally, maybe closer than we expected, but certainly, but then that didn't happen. At the evening wore on, there we were with our Hillary t-shirt and our Bernie cap and holding our sad little balloons, looking at each other and wondering what the hell has happened. I didn't sleep very well that night. And the next morning, I got up and looked at New York Times, where they had done an exit poll to try to determine who the voters were, particularly not so much the racists of the southern states, who kind of thought that the tide would turn that direction, but what happened in Michigan and what happened in Ohio and what happened in Pennsylvania and what happened in Wisconsin. And the New York Times had done an exit poll and determined that in general, the voters agreed with most of us that this man really didn't have the character to be president, that they were disturbed at a lot of his personal traits. But there were two issues that were decisive for them. And one was the issue of immigration, of these, their minds, people coming in, not simply to change the cultural equation of America, but also to endanger American jobs, or at least so they thought, or to threaten American security, or so they thought. And the other was entangling foreign arrangements, particularly economic ones, trade, the kind of trade deals that made it possible for countries like China, for example, to rise and do the kind of secure, good union-paying jobs that people in Pennsylvania and Rust Belt of the northern tier of Midwestern states in the United States had counted on. Those jobs vanished, and they blamed international trade, the globalization of trade, as a result. And those two issues on which Trump hammered over and over again turned out to be decisive for them. And a kind of bell went on in my mind, and I remembered right after the Brexit vote in the UK, which similarly was a vote that no one expected, and they, how could it be possible that UK would leave the European Union? And in the UK also, after the Brexit vote, a exit poll was made, and the two issues that were decisive were immigration and international trade. Now, immigration and international trade are kind of fundamental aspects of globalization. They're fundamental aspects of the globalized world where demographic shifts allows everyone to live everywhere, for people to have easy mobility of transportation and people to move in different parts of the world. And the kind of unsettling changes in the Middle East and elsewhere that make massive refugees transportation possible and necessary. So immigration is a fundamental aspect of globalization and international trade. What else? Globalization is a code word in many cases for the kind of modern technologies, modern economics that allows everything to be made, everything to be distributed everywhere, to be merchandised and marketed everywhere. We live in an era of economic globalization, which is exactly the kind of thing that disturbed the voters of Brexit and the voters for Trump. So in a very fundamental way, the rise of Trump and the rise of Brexit is the rise of a new kind of phenomenon, a new kind of global phenomenon of anti-globalism. And it's not just in UK and in the United States. The rise of the fear of the other that gives a kind of privilege for ethnic identities of local ethnic communities is something that is enshrined in politics, particularly of popularist demagogic politics around the world, whether it's Russia, where the Russian Orthodox Church has played a very significant role in the rise and support of Putin, or in Turkey, where Erdogan is able to marginalize the Turks and the Kurds and other Armenians and other minority communities in favor of a kind of Turkish identity, or al-Sisi in Egypt, or in India, where even this morning, the largest state in India, Uttar Pradesh, just chose with the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the Indian National Party, a Hindu cleric, an anti-Muslim cleric, as the chief minister of the state, a kind of Donald Trump of India. In Myanmar, rabid Buddhist-like monks like Ashin Virotu are goading Burmese into fighting Muslims with the fear that the purity of Myanmar, Burmese cultural nationalism is being sullied by the other, by these foreigners. The globalization, which in one sense has brought the world closer together, has in another sense been the occasion for a new kind of phenomenon, a new kind of ethnic and religious tribalism, and a new fear of the economic entanglements that make the global economy work, but also which, by its very nature, makes local economies less important, less central to the local economies of which people, for which people over the years have taken a great deal of comfort. So, we live in a kind of diametrically opposite moments of centrifuge, of spinning inward and spinning outward of dynamics of globalization that bring us further together and also drive us further apart. I've been a part of the program of global studies at Santa Barbara since its inception, and way back in the 20th century, 1995, you can believe it, we actually had a global studies program back then. It's a field of studies dedicated to the understanding of the role of societies, cultures, economies in an era of globalization. And one of my colleagues after the Trump election said, well, I guess your business is over. No globalization here. And I said, no, actually, our business has just begun. Because perhaps there's nothing more global than anti-globalism. that the phenomenon of the rise of new forms of tribalism, a new fear of demographic shifts and economic homogenization is a global phenomenon and something that global studies as a field has to seriously consider. So global studies as a field is dedicated to the understanding of global trends. It's what we try to do, what we try to make sense out of. Global studies as a field is fundamentally transnational and transcultural. That is, we do not take the idea of the nation state as the single and dominant form of entity within the transnational phenomenon. We focus on trends, flows, and processes that are beyond the character of the nation state, and they have to look at it in ways that are interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, and ultimately transdisciplinary. In my own Department of Global Studies, in Santa Barbara, for example, we have people who are economists, historians, sociologists, who focus on literature. And yet when we work together as a common faculty because all of these dimensions are intertwined. And so we need the resources of a multiple of disciplines and ultimately a perspective that transcends disciplinary narrowness in trying to understand the character of transnational phenomenon. We are then necessarily problem-oriented, that is, looking at specific issues in the world, from global civil society to global economic issues and identity and health and governance, that necessarily involve people from different disciplines and different points of view. And for that reason, the perspective of the studies have to be multiple as well. And by that I mean not just from different disciplines, but from different angles of vision, from gendered angles, of racial angles, of cultural angles, to take seriously the fact that globalization appears differently from different parts of the world. It looks differently from the global south than it does from the global north. When I talk to my students, I often take the example of McDonald's as a case of the kind of paradigmatic case of globalization. But even McDonald's looks different in different places. This is McDonald's in Kyoto. And McDonald's in Kyoto, they have rice with their McDonald's. In McDonald's in Delhi, they have everything except beef. Because it's India, you don't eat the cow. You can have veggie patties and veggie burgers at McDonald's, but you can't have beef. In Italy, if you go to McDonald's, you can have a glass of wine with your Big Mac. Because it's Italy. Everything goes with wine in Italy. So even though such a simple global phenomenon as McDonald's looks different from different points of view, this is even more the case for more other aspects of globalization that perhaps are more profound and less trivial. And finally, global studies is concerned about global citizenship, taking responsibility for changes in the world from political to environmental, and to respond as global citizens, as leaders in global civil society. Which brings us back to the phenomenon of anti-globalism as a global topic. It's something that in the field of global studies is an issue not only of intellectual concern, but because we are concerned about global leadership and our role in thinking about the quality of global civil society for the future, something that concerns us as global citizens as well. It's a global topic, as I said, not only in the case of Brexit, but in the rise of Trump, where the issues of immigration and economic trade deals are very much a part of the concern of the voters, but part of the rise of Putin and Erdogan and Al-Sisi and Duterte in the Philippines, the new kind of male demagogic figures, the kind of popularist heroes who often use the kind of tropes of ethnic cleansing and ethnic purity, of economic control as devices upon which they can build their own structures of power. In a curious kind of way, some of the resistance movements and the anti-authoritarian movements of the contemporary world, including some of the most violent, are also, in a sense, anti-globalist movements. You can see ISIS in a very curious kind of way as the dark side of Arab Spring, as a kind of move of popularism, an attempt to try to seize control for an ethnic community which felt itself marginalized. And this is certainly the case of this movement, which we think of as a kind of a radical religious terrorist movement. But a couple months ago, when I was in Kurdistan, I was able to go to the refugee camps, in this particular case, near Mosul, just outside the city of Mosul, which is currently in the process of being cleansed of ISIS control. And these huge refugee camps of tens of thousands of people who are fleeing East Mosul, fleeing for their lives, are trying to stake claim to restructure their lives and find their future. But they're also in a wonderful opportunity for someone like me to try to understand what life was like under ISIS control. These are people who have been living in Mosul for the last several years, and they know what ISIS is like. And one of the fellows said that ISIS was a strange religion. It was a strange religion that was basically, in his mind, more political than it was religious. It was an attempt to try to create an artifact or artifice of political control out of Sunni Arab ethnic identity. It was very easy to trace the history of ISIS going back to al-Zarqawi and the early years in 2004 after the American intervention and control of Iran, Iraq, where the Sunni Arabs felt themselves marginalized in a way that they hadn't before. After all, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. But now that a new era of democracy came, democracy to the Sunni Arabs meant that the Shia would become the masters of Iraq and they would marginalize Sunnis. And that's exactly, of course, what happened. Al-Zarqawi was the first of the Al-Qaeda and Iraq figures who came under control to some extent through American efforts to intervene and to empower the Sunni Arabs. But once the Americans left in 2011, once again under al-Maliki and the new Iraq regime, the Sunni Arabs were marginalized, and once again, a new movement, one that al-Zarqawi had been a part of, al-Qaeda in Iraq, revived itself under a new leadership, although al-Baghdadi, the current leader of ISIS, was one of the guys who was involved with al-Qaeda in Iraq under al-Zarqawi. But they were able to mobilize precisely because in Iraq, the Sunni Arabs were marginalized. And in Syria, just across the border, once again, the Sunni Arabs were marginalized in a regime that privileged Alawites, a kind of Sunni community in Syria. So it was an attempt to create an ethnic identity entity within the region that gave strength and possibility for the rise of ISIS in a curious kind of way. They were responding to exactly the same sorts of dynamics, the same kind of anti-globalist attempts to recreate an ethnically homogenous and pure form of entity, a surprising resurgence of cultural nationalism in an era of globalization that we see in Brexit and the rise of Trump. It may seem odd to you to put together such disparate sorts of things in the same category, but it seems to me that all of these movements in some way share this common resistance to elements of globalization and can be seen as a part of the strange religion of anti-globalization. Well, these are my kind of sleepy, jet-lagged comments, and I'm going to kind of bring it to a close now with the thought that we can have a good conversation, because this is a topic about which all of us have comments and insights. So I'm willing to and looking forward to hearing your own perspective on these issues. So thank you very much for being patient and hearing what I've had to say.